A new investigation into Wall Street's role in the mortgage mess.
And this one might actually have some teeth.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, May 17th.
Coming up, a report on what the New York Attorney General is looking into on Wall Street.
We're going to find out how Europeans are feeling about all the bailouts over there.
And someone had his 25,000th Big Mac today, which is something you don't get to say every day, Steve. And it is something you will hear about coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Let's start with the news out of New York this morning. The state's attorney general is reportedly investigating how big banks packaged mortgages into securities during the housing boom. Now, the investigation is said to include Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
One key building block of the housing crisis was securitization, banks pooling home mortgages, then selling the securities onto investors. Now, the New York Attorney General is looking into the role Wall Street banks played. Did they know how risky these mortgage pools were and perhaps try to hide that when they marketed them to investors? This is significant because New York's Attorney General has powers that others don't, something called the Martin Act of 1921. Basically, it's a big stick, only available under New York state law, with sweeping subpoena powers and a low bar for proving financial fraud, according to Chris Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics.
Most of the securities world operates under New York law, and insurance companies that wrote cover for mortgage-backed securities did so from New York. Combine that with the punitive aspects of the Martin Act, it really has probably more teeth.
Whalen says New York could hit targets harder than the feds, and this may signal the New York Attorney General doesn't want to go for a weaker settlement that other states are pursuing over abuses of homeowners in foreclosure. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now let's get to the world's largest retailer, Walmart, a company so big it is its own economic indicator. Walmart said this morning that profits jumped almost 4% last quarter, but U.S. sales were down for the eighth straight quarter. Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she joins us from St. Louis every Tuesday, and she's with us now. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So what do these Walmart numbers tell you?
Well, basically, it says that in spite of incredible efficiencies, because they are the biggest, and we're seeing here they're not immune from rising costs, and that's fuel and transportation. And even China, who's the biggest source of product, costs are rising. They can't squeeze the costs out much more, hurts profit margins. And it's the sheer size. They own the discount space in America. Kmart doesn't even count anymore. So mathematically, when you have a big percentage, you can't rise significantly if you already own it. So you go for the small growth, wholesale and international.
And Julie, as you say, Walmart is a discount store. In that case, would falling sales in the U.S. mean that maybe the economy is getting better? People are moving up.
Well, it's better and worse. You know, you've got an income reversal here. Higher income is moving back up to Target, up to Dillard's, up to Saks. On the other hand, lower income is still moving lower, and the Walmart shopper has gone down to Family Dollar Store and the Dollar Tree, and that is continuing here. So their share of the pie is actually getting smaller there, and the dollars available for spending are significantly lower on the lower income side because of fuel cost. Middle income, the money is going to the gas tank, not into the shopping cart.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, Jeremy and Julie, builders broke ground on fewer homes last month. Housing starts for the month fell by more than 10% as a glut of homes on the market probably discouraged a lot of home builders from breaking ground on new ones.
In Florida, that glut has a lot to do with all the foreclosures, which has caused prices to plummet the past few years. But today, some hope, at least in Broward County, which saw the biggest year-over-year jump in median home prices in 5 years. From station WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone filed this report.
What we have here, this is a typical three-bedroom, two-bath.
This is sound of me standing with realtor John Luca in front of a home he sold in February.
So I was thinking if there were going to be a movie preview for this, it would go like this.
Luca's been selling in Broward since the 70s. It's been so bad lately, I figured he deserved a little over-dramatization for this particular sale.
In a single-family home with three bedrooms.
John Luca does it again.
To understand, you need to know just how bad things got for Broward real estate. From the peak 5 years ago, home prices have fallen by half. Florida just received federal money for a program called the Hardest Hit Fund. Broward led the state in applications. Terry Bursack, a local leader with the Realtor Board of Directors, told me asking how the real estate crash affected Broward County.
It's like asking how Hurricane Andrew may have affected everyone in South Florida.
Which is to say, yeah, some neighborhoods weren't hit as hard, but it's a hurricane. So in that context, John Luca's sale was heroic. Luca told the owners to not expect anything above 260, if even that. Much to his surprise, the home got 265.
It's good to have happy customers and to see also that there's a little bit of movement in the market.
The best phrase would be a squeeze play.
Bill Hardin is the director of real estate studies at Florida International University. He says the movement in Broward actually comes from restriction. In the past few months, there's been a sort of freeze on foreclosure processing. Several major law firms are under investigation for how they handle the paperwork in foreclosures. Hardin says that forced lenders to double-cross their T's and triple-dot their I's before putting distressed property back on the market.
It takes now over 600 days from start to finish of that process.
And so inventory has dropped, prices have kicked up.
So yeah, at first it looks like everything is copacetic.
Brad Hunter is head of national consulting for the Realty Tracking Group, Metro Study.
But then there's, of course, the elephant in the middle of the room, and that is shadow supply.
There's still loads of foreclosure properties stuck in the pipeline. So the question for realtors is, will that come as a trickle or a tsunami and flood the market? In Broward County, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Hewlett-Packard cut its full-year outlook this morning, saying Japan's earthquake and weak PC sales are taking their toll.
There is a Senate hearing in Washington today regarding the financial health of the U.S. Postal Service. The USPS lost $2.2 billion last quarter and says it may not be able to pay its bills come September.
There are more numbers, rain, snow, sleet, dead of night, all there at our website, by the way. Just check out the numbers section at marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Now to the marketplace global perspective. British oil giant BP had planned to team up with the Russian state-controlled oil firm Rosneft in a deal that would have opened up part of the Arctic for exploration. But that plan has been nixed, the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
This was to be the deal that showed BP was back in business after the disastrous spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year. Its chief executive, Bob Dudley, believed a tie-up with Rosneft would prove BP was still a major player and could deliver growth. Nick McGregor is an oil analyst at Redmayne Bentley in London. He says BP has lost a lot of credibility.
It was potentially a good deal, but that they didn't stitch this up first of all and get a binding pre-agreement from their existing Russian partners really does call into question quite a lot about the way this deal and BP's being managed. And what people really want to see at the moment is absolute confidence in BP's management, not extra question marks.
McGregor says Dudley should have known better, especially since he'd previously headed up BP's Russian operations. BP had tried to reach a compromise with its billionaire partners, who argued any investment in Russian oil had to be done through them. But Rosneft is now free to strike a deal with other companies to look for oil in the Russian Arctic, and one of those is thought to be ExxonMobil. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
European finance ministers are meeting in Brussels today, looking at whether Greece will need yet another round of financial help. The ministers already approved a $111 billion bailout package for Portugal. Reporter Christopher Wirth is in London this morning. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning.
So I remember Greece received more than $150 billion in bailout money last year. Is it going to need more help?
Greece has about an $85 billion funding gap in its budget, and it's really going to struggle to pay back what it already owes. For a while now, we've been hearing from economists that the only way Greece is going to tackle this problem is by restructuring its debt. In other words, Greece simply wouldn't pay the full amount it owes, and investors could be out a lot of money. But the question is how to minimize that pain. And what's emerged out of these talks is that, you know, this week is a new pleasant-sounding term, which is reprofiling.
Reprofiling. What is that?
Well, it's sort of a compromise. Instead of reducing the amount of Greece's debt, what you're doing is extending the time Greece has to pay it back. So say an investor bought a 2-year bond, they may get their money back in 10 years instead. And it may not make investors happy to have to wait for their money, but those investors are still going to get all of their money.
Can it work, Chris?
That's questionable. Here's what Marie Duran of Oxford Economics had to say.
It would need to be accompanied by a new bailout package, as well as Greece saying that it will not be able to repay the total amount of its debt.
Most economists you speak with say you just can't get away from the idea that Greece is going to have to restructure all that money it owes.
Christopher Wirth reporting from London. Chris, thanks.
Hey, thanks.
Well, all these bailouts can get a little annoying, Steve and Chris, for those being bailed out as well as those who are doing the bailing.
Mm.
And Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us some Europeans are getting a bit queasy about their union these days.
At a garbage collection center in Lisbon, workers are on strike protesting the terms of Portugal's bailout. They object to the deep cuts in public spending aimed at reducing the country's debts. Union organizer Luis Dias.
But who is paying these debts? It's the workers, the Portuguese workers, the Portuguese people. It's not the banks, it's not the government, it's we are.
Portugal enthusiastically adopted the euro, but union official Ana Oliveira says the bailout has underlined the downside of belonging to the eurozone.
We cannot manage our deficit as we want. We cannot choose the economic policy we want, but we have to accept what is imposed by the European Union.
There's even more dissatisfaction with the EU in Germany, but for different reasons. On the streets of Berlin, people complain about having to bail out other Europeans after they failed to be as prudent as the Germans.
We, the Germans, also had to face a lot of social cuts in order to avoid to get into trouble as Portugal, Ireland or Greece now is.
I mean, it's their problems, not ours. Why should we do something about it?
Many Germans feel betrayed, says Hans-Olaf Henkel, former head of the Association of German Industries. He says the public voted for a currency union, but they got what Germans call a transfer union instead.
Which means that the German taxpayer in the future will also have to support Greece, Portugal, Spain, probably Italy, and eventually France.
Supporters of the euro say such fears are certainly exaggerated, but the single currency, which was aimed at bringing European countries closer together, appears to be having the opposite effect. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, now to this country and a gas station, Steve, that I wish I had driven by over the weekend here in Los Angeles. It was selling gas for $1.10 a gallon.
What? Where was this gas station?
Well, it was in the Wilmington section of L.A., and police had to direct traffic around the gas station because there were so many customers lined up down the block to get a load of this 110 gas. Turns out it was a computer glitch that caused the problem, and it went on for 4 hours before the attendant noticed why everyone was there and
shut
the pumps down.
So this was unadvertised. This was not advertised.
Well, it was just up on the sign. It said $1.10, and everyone's just like, well, $1.10, I'm going there. So turns out the gas station owner actually lost $21,000 during this four-hour glitch, and now he's asking the customers who benefited from it to come and use some of their savings buying something at his convenience store.
Maybe some Twinkies or a chocolate milk or something like that.
To Georgia now, where the criticism is pouring in after the state's governor, Nathan Deal, signed an Arizona-style immigration bill targeting undocumented residents. Tourism and convention officials in Atlanta fear it will lead to an economic boycott, and there are concerns about the effect it'll have on farmers, as Gene Bonner of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
Georgia's law requires businesses with 11 employees or more to use the federal E-Verify system to make sure workers are legal. Officials in Georgia's agriculture industry are concerned about its impact on the workforce.
You have to have the migrant worker or you don't get your crop in.
That's Charles Hall of the Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association. Hall says without teams of migrant workers, farmers may switch from growing key Georgia crops like peaches and Vidalia onions to other produce that machines can harvest.
A row crop, a cotton, a peanut, a soybean, does not require the hand labor and the harvest labor that vegetables or peaches or blueberries do.
It's unclear how strictly the state will enforce the provision, but the bill's sponsor, Republican State Senator Matt Ramsey, says it removes the number one incentive that brings illegal immigrants to Georgia.
That's access to jobs.
Some of the law's provisions take effect July 1st. In Atlanta, I'm Jean Bonner for Marketplace.
The business-themed social networking site LinkedIn goes public in just a couple of days on Thursday, but it's not getting near the attention of its social networking rivals, Facebook and Twitter, both of which are expected to file for public offerings soon as well. Sally Herships explains why.
Hear that? Yeah, quiet. Tom Tully advises tech companies. He says that silence could be the sound of success.
Yeah, if you don't have the razzle-dazzle, you won't have the crazy valuation.
Tully says frenzy can create big swings in stock prices and regret.
You know, before you make a big commitment, whether it be dating someone or getting married, you may want to think about it once or twice. But when it comes to these hot IPOs, a lot of investors don't.
And end up losing big. Tully says when RenRen, China's version of Facebook, went public, it dropped 50% in a week. He says LinkedIn isn't likely to do that. But will LinkedIn's IPO tell us anything about what might happen with that other social network? Tim Beharin is president of high-tech research firm Creative Strategies.
And I really am not sure you can, you know, look at this and see any indication of how Facebook would be. It really is apples and oranges.
LinkedIn's non-frenzy is expected to raise almost $300 million. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And Steve, I think this is a good time for us to tell listeners that if they want to follow us on Twitter.
What?
We're there.
Do we have Twitter addresses?
We
yes,
do.
We do. Yes, we do.
You are at Radio Chio.
And you are at Jeremy Hobson.
Very easy to remember. Yes. Both of them. Follow us on Twitter.
And finally, and you'll see this on Twitter because I tweeted this, I believe, this morning. Don Gorski will eat Big Mac number 25,000
wow.
today, Jeremy.
The I'm only up actually, to 24,000.
Oh, think. Really? 372 or whatever. Yeah. He's keeping track. And the Wisconsin man has been eating the McDonald's two-patty special sauce favorite for nearly four decades. Two a day every day. Two a day. I think a Big Mac has somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, 500 or 600 calories? And loads of fat and salt and everything yeah. else that goes along with it, and some, you know, some other things as well. Gorski, who's already hit this Guinness World Record for the number of Big Macs he's eaten, says he's in fine health, and his cholesterol, I believe I read somewhere that his cholesterol was somewhere in the 150s,
wow.
which if you keep up with cholesterol, right, this is the main number. If you're under 200, you're in good shape.
That's pretty
so
good,
yeah, 150 is not bad. Although his wife says he doesn't get near enough vitamins.
Well, maybe he should order one of those salad wraps with his Big Mac next time.
Perhaps. Well, I think, you know, I read in some other stories and doing some research on this.
You've been doing a lot of research on the Big Mac story.
This Big Mac guy that his wife is asking him to, instead of drinking all the Cokes that go along with the Big Macs, she's asking him to, like, take some parfaits. So she's getting him to eat ice cream and some, like, juices to go with that.
Sounds
and I'm
healthy.
Like, yeah, that's really healthy. Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe I'll do the all Big Mac diet. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Bon appetit. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.